You there, Joe?
Hey, guys, it's Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, Joe.
How's it going?
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Joe.
I think we got a pretty good crowd here. Let's get going. What I'm going to do is, I've got a bunch of questions from people that have emailed me and a few faxed questions. If you're not talking or if there's background noise where you're at, if you press star six, it'll mute you out. And you can always... You can always hit star six again, and it'll get you back in if you want to talk or ask a question or whatever. So I'm gonna start with just some of the questions that I've got. First with the ones that have been written to me on fact. Well, why don't I do the emails first? It'll be easier. The first one is from Dominic. Dominic, are you on the call, Williams?
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, good. I just noticed here you said I may be a little late. How you doing? I haven't talked to you for a while.
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm doing really good.
Good. Nice to hear your voice again. Okay. Want me just to read your question here?
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask, should I be qualifying each and every person who calls as a result of my ads through my mortgage broker, or should I just put them on the email blast list and take care of the qualifying once the person shows an interest in the property? How big is your list right now?
Right now, it's at about 20 people.
Okay. You know, when it's this small, I think it makes sense to get them qualified.
Okay.
And if you work with a mortgage broker, your mortgage broker should give you a cut on these deals.
Right.
You know, get a half a point on a loan or more, depending on the type of loan that they do. Now, the problem and the one we always struggle with is getting mortgage brokers who will actually do the pre-qualification for you.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy because they're paying, you know, mortgage brokers pay between $10 and $500 per lead. And here you are, you're willing to give them 20 leads right now if they'll just qualify them. And we also know that for those $10 leads, when they go through those, they only get a very small percentage of those deals together. So if they go through yours, and these are for, you know, rent to buy leads that you've got, they go through those, maybe only 10% of those people can qualify for a loan right now.
Uh-huh.
But we know that all of them want to buy a property. So they're great leads, and even though they can't buy right now, they may have credit issues right now, 6 months, a year, 18 months, 2 years, he could build a whole big pipeline for himself of people that are going to get loans.
Right.
And if you're going to be putting these people into rent-to-buy situations, they're going to need to buy a property in a year or, you know, 18 months or 2 years. So it's a great source for them. But even though that's easy for a lot of mortgage brokers to see that it is a good source, it's still hard sometimes to get them to do it and to get them to follow through. So you want to find somebody who's going to be good at it.
And I think I found someone in my uncle. So, I mean, he's willing to work with me and willing to help.
Great.
So I think I've got a good source there. I just didn't know if I should be trying to qualify each and every one of them. I mean, it's kind of hard to stay on top of them, but not impossible, you know, to stay on top of every person that calls.
Now, if you've only gotten 20 now, I mean, wait till you get 900.
Right.
Wait till you get 2,000. Then you just get more people involved to help you do it.
Well, then, should I, as soon as they're on my list, should I call them to let them know, hey, I've received your information and you'll be receiving a list soon, or should I just leave that alone?
Absolutely, call them right away.
Okay.
And because you want to find out a couple of things from them. The first thing, and maybe the most important thing you want to find out, is how much have they got for a down payment?
Mm-hmm.
And don't put in any of your advertising that it takes a certain amount down.
Right.
Never put that in. Always ask, how much have you got for a down payment? And they'll say, well, I got $2,000, or I've got $10,000, or, you know, whatever it is they've got. And if they say, well, I've got $5,000, whatever the number they give you, say, well, you know, could you, if you know, I had something that, you know, for $15,000, could you come up with $15,000? And they say, oh, yeah, I could come up with an extra few thousand bucks for that. Or if they said $2,000, could you come up with $4,000? Oh, yeah, I could probably come up with $4,000. You know, so find out, you know, once they tell you what they'll come up with, then ask them if they've got a little bit more than that.
Okay.
And if they say no, then at least you know where they're at.
Should I keep it on my phone message? I tailor my phone message basically almost exactly like yours. You know, this will require at least $2,000 down. We have a $2,000 down list of 5 and a 10. Should I keep that on the message then?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a good list. It's a good way to do it. That way you get them to tell you when they call in how much they've got for a down payment. Plus, it lets them know before they even opt in that they got to have some kind of down payment. And you're not just dealing with people that don't have any money at all.
Okay.
Because that just gets to be a pain in the butt.
Perfect.
But one of the things that's going to happen when your mortgage broker qualifies them, if they know, we know that about 10% of the people that don't think they qualify for a loan will qualify for a loan. That means that they think they have terrible credit. Maybe they had a bankruptcy 2 years ago, but they've been okay since then.
Mm-hmm.
They probably qualify for a loan. So we could get them a loan right now. So should they be buying rent to buy from you?
No.
Probably not. Yeah, they should probably be going to the MLS and finding one. So then you take that lead. You're going to make money on the loan that they, the mortgage broker is going to give you a cut off of his deal, and then you're going to pass it on to an agent, a real estate agent as well, and get between 25 and 50% of their commission. They, when you approach an agent, they can't give you a percentage of their commission, but they can pay marketing fees, and they can pay a percentage for leads. So when you approach them, don't say, "Will you give me a percentage of your commission?" because they can't do that. But you can say, look, would you pay for a lead, you know, if I brought that in? I don't know what the legal way is for you to do that so that you can give me like 25% of what your commission would be. But, I mean, that's what you'd pay for a referral. Would you pay something along those lines, whatever you call it, to me, and see what they say.
Okay.
And if they won't pay that, then don't work with them. Go get somebody that will.
Right.
Because you'll get paid off of that. And right then, you just made money, you know, if let's say on a $150,000 deal, you've made, you know, maybe a half a point on the loan, so there's, you know, what's that, $750 for the loan, and then, you know, maybe a point and a half or, you know, 1.5% on the, or 1% on the purchase price, you know, another $1,000 or $1,500, $2,000, and you can make money without really doing anything at all except passing the lead on.
Okay.
So I made a couple of grand, $2,000 to $3,000 for doing absolutely nothing except having the people in place that can handle this stuff. Of course, everybody else, you want to know when they qualify, you know, that when the mortgage broker looks at them, you want that mortgage broker to tell you, are they going to qualify in 6 months? Are they going to qualify in a year, 18 months? You know, how long should the lease option period be? Because you want to try to get them on the shortest lease option period possible, because
right.
You want to get your money out of those deals that you're doing as you do them.
Okay.
So good luck on that.
Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So you're moving forward. That's good to hear.
I'm moving forward.
All right. Keep me posted.
Thank you.
Keep
me posted.
I'm a mortgage broker, and if anybody needs help, I can forward my information on because I'm an investor as well as a mortgage broker.
Okay.
And I'd be willing to help anybody out, and I will pay a consulting fee. that's how we pay out the fees to people who send us legally. How we can send out referral fees, consulting fees.
Give us your name and your phone number.
It is Tom O'Connor, and the phone number is 303-757-1464.
Okay. I mean, I don't know you, Tom, but whenever you work with a mortgage broker, I mean, if they're willing to do that stuff and they're willing to pay a fee like that and they're willing to do the work and they follow through with it, I mean, that's the kind of person you want to work with. And somebody that knows what I'm doing might be a benefit to you. So.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
What was that number again?
303-757-1464.
Where are you located, Tom?
In Denver, but where I'm able to do mortgages. In Denver, Colorado, but we're able to do mortgages throughout the United States.
Okay.
Well, good. Thanks. So Dominic, that answers that. Let's go on to the next one. David Ashendel, are you on the line? And you have to press *6 if you muted yourself out. Okay. Some of these people wrote these emails knowing they couldn't be on the call but are going to listen to the recording later. So I'm going to go ahead and read his question and answer it, and then we'll move on to the next one. His question is, if you show up, David, or if you haven't gone, just speak up. No. When getting a property on a subject to deal, whose name is on the taxes, and do the tax responsibilities and advantages, who do they go to? Is it us because we're on the deed, or the seller because the loan remains in their name? Good question. It's in the owner. It goes to you as the deed holder, not to the person who has the loan. So if you take a property subject to the existing loan, and you get the deed for the property, you get the tax benefits as the owner. Same way if you buy it on a land contract or multiple mortgage, not on a lease option, you'll be a tenant at that point. But you don't want to buy on a lease option anyway. Roger Impel, are you on the call?
Yes, I just got on.
Okay, great. Got my message, I take it.
Actually, I didn't. I think I need to have you put me back on your list with the email address I sent you.
Okay.
For some reason, I'm not getting any correspondence from you.
Okay. Not sure why that's happening. Sometimes the spam filters knock people out. So I had a couple folks that had that situation this time. All right, Roger, you want to, instead of me reading this, why don't you summarize the questions for me?
Well, the first one, it refers to your January newsletter where Bob was, I'll just read it. Bob mentioned talking to buyers, calling in off of signs he puts out to qualify them to be on this buyer's list. He mentioned not everyone qualifies to be on this list, and I think the numbers he used were 200 out of the 400. Only 200 out of the 400 were actually put on this list. And my question is, could you go over that process? What questions do you need to ask them to decide whether or not they go on the list, and who qualifies and who doesn't qualify?
Well, they're going to qualify rather if they have money and if they have enough income to make payments. So if somebody calls in, let's say you're in a market like San Francisco, where you know that the cheapest house you can get out there, even in the suburbs, is, you know, $250,000. So you gotta have $1,700 a month or $1,600 a month before there's even a remote possibility that you're buying a house out there. If somebody comes in and says, "Well, I've got, you know, $1,000 of cash right now, and $500 a month is what I can afford," well, that's probably not somebody that you can do much for in that community. So that'd probably not be somebody you'd want to continue to follow up with.
Uh-huh.
If you talk to them and say, "Hey, you know, do you think you're going to be in a position to come up with more money later and more income? You know, what's your possibility here? I mean, you can't even rent a house for that. What are you going to do?" And actually, I was driving around with Bob, and he was getting calls. He's like getting calls all day long, and from buyers calling on his sign. And he had the same situation. You know, in West Palm Beach, you know, you don't get a house for $500 a month. And that was the exact scenario that he was getting a couple of times when I was listening to him. And it's funny because you can't do anything for those folks at this point. So you just try to be nice to them and direct them someplace else. But
hey, Bob, I joined.
Oh, yeah. I was just telling him about our driving around in the car with you and having you talk to those people, that guy saying he had $500 a month.
Yeah.
I mean, that would work in Indiana, you know, places in Indiana. It's not going to work in West Palm Beach.
Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, and to answer Jones' question, I've got an A list, a B list, and you don't make the list at all. And it's those folks that they don't understand rent to own. They're looking for rent. They have no money. They want to pay $500 a month, where the going rate's $1,200 a month. And, yeah, I just don't keep a list of all those people. My list would be so big. So big enough as it is for the – even to make it on the B list, you know, those folks are marginal. So, but the questions you ask are right off the form. Actually, I use the form that's in Joe's contracts to ask questions to, you know, find out if they're qualified for, you know, to make the list. Basically,
not everybody has that. My contracts, Bob.
Oh, gee, wow.
So tell them basically what the questions are.
Well, here I've got it right on my wall here. I get their phone number, email address, find out what kind of house they're looking for, number of bedrooms and baths, if they have any pets, are they looking for a single family home, townhouse, condo, any other particular features, what area, what's their current living arrangement. And then really, that is all good information, but very often I'm just cutting right to the chase and asking, how much do you feel comfortable paying per month? How much do you have for a down payment? Do you have a feeling for what the price of the house would be that you'd consider? And get right to the money matters and try to determine what their current situation is and if they have the means to get into a rent-to-own situation. And I'll ask further qualifying questions about their credit as well. You know, I want to make sure I explain the rent-to-own program. Is that what you're looking for, or are you looking to get a mortgage right now, or is your credit so bad that you just couldn't get a mortgage any time in the next 12 months? And so those are the questions that I ask. But largely, as Joe said, you can cut right to the chase and find out. I ask how many bedrooms and baths, what are you comfortable with on a monthly payment, how about a down payment, and you know the answer whether or not they're a prospect just with those questions.
Does that answer it for you, Roger?
That does, and I have one additional question to add to that. How would you tailor your advertising? Like some of the ads say no qualifying, no income verification, and then all of a sudden they call and they don't qualify, would you, in higher priced areas, would you not include that in your advertising?
You put in the monthly payment. Now, this is, you know, one of the ads that we've run pretty successfully is six homes rent to buy between X dollars and X dollars monthly. No qualifying. They still know that they're going to have to make monthly payments. There's qualification on that level. And then when they call, they're going to find out about the down payment. We actually have a script for a voicemail that's, if you've gotten any of my programs, you've probably gotten the script, which is a script that says, hey, here's how the program works, and we've got three different lists, one with that you need 2,000 down, one that you need 5,000 down, and a list that has you need 10,000 down. Which list do you want? So when people leave their name and number on there, we're getting them to tell us how much they've got for a down payment. And then when we call them back, we try to see if they've got more money than that. But you want to do the follow-up with these people. The other thing that I like that Bob is doing, which we usually, you know, I've been recommended you do it in email follow-ups, but you're suggesting that they go out and find their own property, right, Bob?
Yeah, exactly. And they, rather than them be dependent on you, what I say is, you know, you can really be part of this process and to a large degree pick out exactly the house you want. As you're driving around, you see for sale signs or for rent signs, or you're looking in the classified, and you see houses that you think would be interesting for you to move into, please get me the names and numbers of those owners, because very often I can talk to them on your behalf and make a rent-to-own situation where everybody wins. That way we double our odds. I'll be looking for a house. You'll be looking for a house. And if you'll put some effort into this and work with me, it greatly increases your odds of finding a house. Then will you help me out in this process? And I'll ask them, and they'll say, oh, yeah, we'll go do that. And some do and some don't, but... You know, but at least I let them know that they can, you know, help in the process by participating.
It's hard to get them off their butt sometimes, but I'll tell you, when they do it and they say, hey, I want this property, and you call up that seller and say, I've got somebody who wants to buy your property. I've got a specific person right now ready to buy your property. Man, it's a lot easier to put that deal together because you've got not just a list of 63 people or 123 people that are interested in that area, but you've got a specific person that's seen their property that wants it and is willing to pay the monthly payment that they're asking for. I mean, that's a very powerful, it's almost a slam dunk. All right. Does that answer it, Roger?
Yeah, it does. Do you want me to go to the next question?
Yeah, I'll take one more, and then I'll I know you have several here. And
well, I do. I don't know which one is the most important, but okay. I guess I'll just take the next one. And this relates to the question that I first asked, and it says, if you have automated the list building process by having a form on your website from AWeber or some other online database service, I assume you later call these buyer prospects to claim the list. And then, by the way, how efficient has the automated process been working when compared to taking live calls and manually putting them on the list?
Bob, you want to answer that one since you're doing that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the manual is a lot more time-consuming and cumbersome. And the whole idea is through this qualifying process to see how serious they are about a place, getting a place for themselves. Just to make a phone call is nice, but if they make a phone call and they also go to your website and then they also fill out the information on the website to get a list of the properties that are available and then they call you back, as you might imagine, the calls that you take are much more qualified. I bet you 80%, that's probably conservative, of the calls I get, I shouldn't even take. So I've had a couple different ways of automating that process, largely through my voicemail, which directs them to the website, and then that whole process is just it qualifies them automatically for you, so you're not wasting a lot of time. So even on my callbacks, if I have somebody that leaves a message, I call them back and tell them a little bit about this process. You know, you need to put $5,000 or $10,000 down. You need to be able to qualify for a mortgage. You should go to my website and register. That way you'll find out what's available. And if they go through, got a real prospect. If they don't, I'm probably wasting my time.
When you're getting 20, 30, 40, you know, 50 leads a day, I mean, there's no way that you can call all those people. So you've got to have an automated process to get them into the mix and get them going and to find out if they really are qualified. And what Bob is talking about is the way you do that. You make them jump through hoops.
Uh-huh.
And the people that jump through the hoops, you know, are have a much higher level of qualification. Does that mean you're going to lose some of those? Yeah, you are. And if you have them leave their information on a voicemail rather than going to a website, you're going to lose some just because you can't understand what they're saying, or they forget to give you their email, or they spell it, they don't spell it for you, or they have a heavy accent and you can't understand what the heck they're saying. We lose them that way. And we've also had them where we send them to live answering services, and then the live answering service types in the information, but they don't get all the information, or they spell the names wrong, or there's always mistakes being made. But you'd make mistakes too if you were doing it. Maybe not as bad as a low-level worker who you're paying to do it would make. But mistakes are going to be made when you build these databases. That's why it makes sense to have more numbers, have as many of them coming in as possible. And when that starts happening, things are going to come out through the funnel, and you're going to make money on those people. Plus, there's the advantages to having a lot of people on the list because there's other things that you can sell them to, which you can get into monetizing your lists other ways. A lot of the things that I'm teaching in this process is not just about doing real estate deals, but how to monetize your list the best way, how to build these lists and monetize them, and make big chunks of cash on each time you monetize it. Does that answer it?
That does.
Okay, good. We'll come back to you if we have more time, Roger. Okay, with the rest of the questions.
Great.
All right. The next one I've got here is Carl Anderson from Florida. Carl, you on the line? Oh, good. Want me to read this, or do you want to summarize it for us?
Well, go ahead.
Okay.
I'm curious. Whereabouts in Florida are you from, Mark?
Apopka.
Sorry?
Apopka.
Okay.
Near Orlando.
West Palm Beach.
Okay. All right. Is this Bob?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice to meet you.
Okay. This is a what-if question, not a real-life event for me yet. When I have a signed lease option contract with a seller, let's say for $210,000 at $1,600 monthly, and I have a lease option tenant buyer that will be buying the property at $245,000 with $1,800 monthly with a $35,000 assignment fee, do I write a new lease option contract with the tenant, or do I give the seller a new contract reflecting the $245,000 price? I mean, that's not really normal to get a $35,000 assignment fee on that. That's great if you can pull it off, but those are going to be fairly rare to get the full value from a property with the assignment fee. It's possible, but especially on this price, if you're dealing with a higher priced property, you can get more of a down payment. And Bob's pretty regularly getting $10,000 on $500,000 deals, and I think that's realistic to do that. You could probably get more than that, but we're just talking about lease options and getting in a basic assignment fee and getting in and out of the deal. Are you talking about the lease option fee, or are you talking about an assignment fee, or are you talking about getting your equity out when you sell it?
Well, I think what I was listening to the CD, and there was one of the phone calls you made from one-year events. Bob had actually made the phone call. And he was talking about he had a home that the seller would take as low as 230, and he had someone he could probably get into it at around 265. And we talked about stepping the amount.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh. What's up?
If you could just press *6, it'll mute you out. We won't have to hear you.
Hello,
ma'am?
Find out. Give me a call back so I can
Anyway, what I was getting at is if I had a home that I had contracted with a seller at 210, but I know there's more in it to be made, and I could find a buyer at 245, then how would that really be a lease option, or would I? I mean, that's $35,000 difference.
Well, if you can take the property, I mean, there's a couple ways. Well, there's lots of ways you can do this, but let's maybe we should go through the scenarios. There's a lady talking in the background. If she could press *6, yeah. It'll mute you out. Ma'am, you can do that for us. We won't have to hear you. *6, and it'll mute you out. If there's any noise in the background, please press *6. It'll make all of us happy.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we got a lot of people on this call. Sorry, guys. I don't mean to be rude, but I, it is rude to make noise. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about the different ways that you could do a deal like this. Because if you have this equity in the property, if the guy is willing to do a subject to a deal, you can take over the.
Okay, I said that because I'm waiting for two calls and in fact, but that's free. I'll tell him.
You can take over the mortgage, and then you can turn around and sell that property for more money. And you could sell it on terms, or you could sell it for cash. You could do an auction on that property if you wanted to. There's enough spread in there to make that happen. Or you could sell it on a lease option, probably for even more than its value. Take a lease option fee, and then within a year or whatever the lease option period is, they come in and refinance the property again.
Okay. See ya. Bye.
Okay, she's hanging up.
Yeah. All right. Bye.
Goodbye. Okay.
Yeah.
All righty. You really lost my train of thought here. Okay. So you can do it as a subject to. You could do it as an auction. And you can take that money out. You could turn around and sell it on the MLS, for that matter, if you wanted to. But you'd have to be making payments on it during the time that you're doing that. There's so many different ways that you can do that when you've got equity in the property like that, and if they're willing to do terms. Or you could just do a quick flip on it and take $10,000 out of it, let them have the lease option. Let's say if it was in an area that you're maybe is 100 miles away from you, you don't want to be a landlord there, you can get this property, you can flip it, you make, take $10,000 out of it, they can take over the property, and you're in and out. Maybe your margins are a little lower, you don't have as much equity, and you can flip it that way. Does that answer the question, or did I miss it?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I guess what you're saying is, if I have that contract originally at $210,000, and then I do an assignment fee, let's say $5,000, they get that lease option agreement at $210,000, the new buyer.
Now, if you're buying it subject to, that's different than buying a lease option. You understand that, right?
No, maybe I don't.
Okay. If you buy a property subject to the existing loan, what they're doing is deeding you the property. This is the best way to buy these properties. They deed you the property. Their name is still in the loan. Let's say they owe $160,000 on it, and they're going to sell it to you for $210,000. So you buy it from them. I'm getting too complicated here.
Mm-hmm.
Let me rethink this. Here, let's say that they owe $210,000 on this property. It's worth $250,000. They're willing to let it go for what they owe on it, and they're willing to leave their name on the note, deed it to you. You now owe it. You're going to be making payments on that $210,000 every month. That's subject to the existing loan.
Okay.
Okay? Now, if I want to turn around and sell that property, I can sell it any way I want. I can sell it with a lease option to a new lease option buyer. Charge them a lease option fee. If it's worth $250,000, I could probably get $260,000 for it, get $10,000 lease option fee, and in a year they can pay it off and I'll make another $40,000, $50,000. So that's a sweet way to sell the property. In the meantime, you're essentially a landlord, but you've got a lease option buyer in there, so they're the one responsible to take care of the property. Your name's not on the loan. You didn't put any down payment on it. You know, you're getting credit for the taxes every year. You know, you can have a depreciation credit. If the person doesn't buy it, the lease option buyer doesn't end up buying it, the value is probably going to appreciate, and you can sell it for more later. If they default on it, at least you've got their lease option fee, and you can use that to help offset any cost, maybe a month or two on the rent while you're trying to find a new lease option tenant to put in there. And you make another lease option fee, which is going to be more than that, so you actually make more money if they default, if the lease option buyer defaults. So that's one way to do it. So that's subject to and selling on a lease option. But if I had it subject to, I could also sell it subject to simply by giving somebody $10,000 or $20,000, and I will deed this property to you. You know, and a lot of times if I have a property, let's say I've got a property for $210,000, I've got it, and I bought it subject to, and it's worth maybe $220,000. I can say, look, I'll sell this to you with $10,000 lease option fee. You'll owe me another, $10,000 plus the $210,000 in a year. Or you can give me $15,000 now, and I'll just deed it to you, and it'll be your property. give them some incentive by giving you more cash now to take that property and actually get it as an owner instead of just a lease option tenant. And so you just sweeten the deal to make that happen.
Okay.
What about the first month or so, or first 2 months, in order to find a tenant to keep in it? Do you write in the contract that they keep the note for 30 or 60 days?
Are you trying to find a lease option tenant?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about when you're buying?
In particular, there's equity in the property, same situation, and someone, I guess, they're willing to deed it over or whatever.
Okay.
And there's equity in the property. And
right.
If I'm looking for someone who would take it subject to or lease option.
You just don't close until you have somebody to put into it.
Oh, okay. You don't
close. So you give yourself a 90-day period to close it. Now, the better you get at this, the sooner you're going to want to close it. You may want to take the deed over when you get good at this. And actually go over and say, look, I'll just take that property. I know what it's worth. I know that I can put a tenant in it. I'll make the payments on it until I get somebody in it because it's worth it. But until you get to that point, just don't close a deal unless you know you're going to make money. So you make money at closing. So what happens is they're going to deed it to you, and you write up a purchase agreement that they're going to deed this property to you, subject to, and you've got 90 days to close. And then you put a sign in the yard, rent to buy. And you get calls on it. You find somebody wants to rent to buy it from you at a higher price, give you a lease option fee, covers your monthly mortgage plus some, so you have monthly income from it. And then you go back to your seller and say, okay, I'm ready to close. You take your lease option fee, you close the deal. Now you've got somebody moving into the property. You make money on the day you close. You had absolutely no risk because your purchase agreement said if you don't find somebody, if you don't put a tenant in there, then you don't have to buy that property. You don't have to put a loan on it. You don't have to put a down payment on it. You're getting money at closing. This is a sweet way to buy property. And this is the core of what I've been teaching.
All right, yeah. So that's basically what I was looking for, is just set the closing for 90 days.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Always try to get about 90 days.
Can I put in a quick question here, Joe?
Sure.
This is Eric Bones in Maryland, Laurel, Maryland.
Okay.
Legally, how long can you hold somebody's property for without a purchase agreement? Is it 90 days, 120? What is the extent of the law here?
Well, it's whatever you guys agree to.
There's okay.
Not, I don't think there's a law that says you have to. You can do years if you wanted to. You gotta have a purchase agreement. I don't think I would structure it that way if I was going to go for years. I'd probably structure it as an option or something like that if I was going to go for a long period of time. But 90 days, 120 days, 6 months, I mean, these are normal periods of escrow. They're a little long, but they're normal. It's not
okay.
Nobody's going to question that. If you're going to do a long-term period, then do an option or do some other type of ownership position.
What types of options are we talking about here?
Just a normal option to purchase a property, you can buy, is what I was mentioning here. So if you wanted to have a long term on a property, usually they're done as lease options because the seller is going to want to get his monthly covered. But if you can get just a straight option without having to pay anything monthly on it, and this is done on land often, where you can get an option, and a lot of times you have to pay a lease option fee on that. So that's possible.
Okay.
And, so, you know, an option just gives you the right to buy the property at a specific price within a specific time frame.
Hi, Joe.
Hey.
Hi, this is Kiwana. How are you doing?
Hey, Kiwana. How's it going?
I'm doing okay.
Good. Nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear you. Yeah. I have a quick question. I recently put an ad in the paper, and
does it refer to these other, Kiwana, before I'm going to cut you off a second, does it refer to the other thing that we're dealing with? Because I wanted to go through the emails first.
Okay.
And then I'll come back and I'll open it up for everybody else to make questions.
Because
I promised everybody in all the letters that I would answer these questions first and then I'd go to the next.
Okay, not a problem. I can wait.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm, thanks.
Okay, the next question I've got is from Ryan Kelly. Ryan, are you in the call? Okay, I'm just going to read it here. I have a question about how to handle the insurance on a subject to property. Do you open a new landlord policy in your name and have the seller cancel their old homeowner's policy? Won't this tip off the lender? Do you have the seller named as an additional insured on your policy, or should you have the seller switch their current homeowner's insurance policy to a landlord policy? If so, will this cover us, or will it only cover the seller if something happens to the house? I've heard of both being done, but wanted some feedback on the way you prefer to do it. What Ryan's concerned about here is the subject to, or the due on sale clause in almost every mortgage that exists out there. So if somebody deeds you the property, and they have an existing loan on the property, well, all those loans say that if you sell a property, you need to pay off, you have to pay off the loan. And if you don't do that, then you're in default on the loan. Now, the question becomes, though, will the lender foreclose just because you're in default under these terms? And in my experience, I've not seen that happen before. I've never seen it happen before. I saw a lender threaten it once, but they backed off when they realized there was no equity in the property. In most of these deals, there's not going to be a ton of equity in these properties. If there's big equity in these properties, then it's more likely that the lender would foreclose, but you probably wouldn't do it this way, or it would only be a short-term transfer. Because even if they do foreclose, it's going to take them a period of time to do that, usually 3 to 6 months to foreclose on a deal. And then they'd have to find out about it before it happens. And so Ryan's question was, by changing the insurance policy on the property, is the lender going to find out that the property was transferred and that the way triggering that due on sale clause? And my feeling is that even if they do find out about it, it probably won't make any difference if there's not a ton of equity in that property. And if they do find out about it and they do foreclose on you, what have you lost? Well, you don't have any money into the deal. You don't have any credit on the deal. They can't sue you personally. The person they have the right to is the person who sold the property. And even then, they're just going to take the property back normally. If you have a lease option tenant in there, they could be damaged. So those are the people that could be hurt in a situation like that. But like I said, I've never seen it happen. I've seen hundreds of these deals go down. I've never seen a due-on-sale clause called before. I doubt that it's going to be a problem. I would not put a ton of my own money into a property that was in, had a loan from somebody else on it.
Can't do that right here, Ben. You got to go in the other room and do that.
Because I was concerned.
Turn on the light.
Because I was concerned about that that issue. So my feeling is, go ahead. You need to have a landlord policy on that property. Now, if you're nervous about the due on sale clause, what I would do is keep the existing loan on there, because a lot of times those loans are escrowed. The money to pay those insurance policies are escrowed. So keep that on there if you're nervous about the due on sale clause, and then go get an additional landlord policy. If you're not concerned about it, then just go get an additional landlord policy and let the lender know that you got it and that you're taking over as managing the property. And, send them a letter. I mean, that's what Nina's been doing. She just sends them a letter, says, I'm taking over as management of this property. All the payments are going to be coming from me now, and here's the new insurance policy. And so far, she's not had any problems with it. So, you know, you have to decide what your level of risk is going to be. Okay, let me move to the next one here. Ben Arnold, are you on the call? Ben, did you make it?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Hi, Joe.
I know you got quite a few questions here. Why don't we take one or two of them, and then if we have time, we'll come back for more of them, okay?
Sure.
So go ahead and give me the best two you got.
Well, in listening to Nina's talk on the last CD, it seemed like her eviction rates were pretty high. She was talking about 2 per month, but she has 65 homes. So, that's running 24, and I'm wondering, are these tenant buyers that she's put in on a lease option, or are these ones that they've made that substantial option fee, and then she still has to evict them?
Well, this is we're talking. First of all, we're only talking 4%, 4% eviction process.
I guess I was looking at 37%.
Did you say 2 per month?
2 per month, 12 months is 24.
Well, you got to look at it monthly. I mean, if you're looking at annual, then you got to divide by 12, because it's a monthly figure that you're looking for. you're looking at if it's over the entire period, it's still a fairly small number. But let me get to the real question, because these statistics don't matter. What matters is because you're going to have different statistics depending on the type of neighborhood you're in. The lower the income of the neighborhood, probably the higher the eviction rate and default rate is going to be. So if you have lower income properties where they're getting $500-$700 a month on those types of deals versus, you know, $1,500 a month or $2,000 a month, you'll probably have a higher eviction rate on the lower priced properties. Although you'd be surprised that people that are paying $3,000, $4,000, and $5,000 a month, there's lots of defaults in those too. But still, I think you're going to have, you know, you may have, if you have cheaper properties, that's going to happen. But it's not that hard to get new people in there. And she's usually got somebody new in there within 30 days. And her lease option fee that the new person pays usually is enough to cover the loss from the eviction, and probably more than that because she'll get more lease option fee. Nina also takes lower lease option fees than a lot of people that I know. I like to get higher lease option fees because I like more cash flow from the thing, but she's happy just to get the thing filled. So she's willing to take less of a lease option fee. But she's still usually getting more than 1 month's rent as a lease option fee. So if it takes 30 days to get somebody out, and she acts pretty quickly when somebody doesn't pay their rent. And Indiana real estate landlord laws are favorable to the landlord. If you're in Florida or in California, Santa Monica, you know, you're in different places like that, the landlord laws are really prohibitive for the landlord and really in favor of the tenant, and they can drag you on for months. So you got to know what your landlord laws are in your particular area to be able to deal with that type of thing. So it's good to just go down to the county courthouse and ask, hey, what does it take to evict somebody around here? And they'll tell you. They'll give you the documents that you need and everything. Or you can talk to a real estate attorney, and they'll tell you the same thing.
Right. Okay.
Does that answer the question?
Yes. Uh-huh. Relevant to that question.
Okay.
Isn't it different? A tenant, just a renter, is different from a lease option, right? As far as like landlord laws and rent, you know, rental laws go, I think.
It depends on the sophistication of your tenant, because there are some ownership rights by being by having an option on the property. But they still have to abide by the lease option. Now, they may – one of the things that we do is we keep the lease and the option separate. So they're two different documents. If you default on one, you've defaulted on both of them. So essentially, if you default by not paying your monthly rent, you've defaulted on your option. So you're not entitled to either of them. But somebody could make the argument, and again, I don't see this happen very often. I've heard of it happening once or twice, but I've never actually experienced it personally, where the tenant will say, yeah, I'm defaulted on my lease, and I'm going to be evicted from my lease, but I still have the option on the property, and I intend to buy it, you know, next year. So I want to keep my option. But even though they've defaulted on their option because they've defaulted on their lease, and then they go to court and say, look, you've got to evict, you can't just evict me, you have to foreclose on this option, you have to take it back through legal means.
That's what I thought you'd have to do, is do a foreclosure on them.
There's a guy that actually teaches how to put together a trust and to avoid that happening, but I don't think it's necessary. You know, maybe you'll get in a situation, you'll say, Joe, you should have told me it was necessary because it happened to you, but I think that it's more work than is necessary. And once again, the way we're doing these deals, you don't have a lot at risk. So if the deal does go south, and even if everything falls apart and you can't do anything with that problem, you just have to walk away from it, you haven't lost anything. It's not hurting your credit. It's not hurting your income. So that's the worst-case scenario for you. So does it make sense to go through all that paperwork and spend that money to make that stuff happen and go through the pain of doing all that stuff, or just to Just assume that most people, when they default on one, they're just going to walk away from the deal because they know they're not entitled to it and they're not going to win. You know, but if they want to create pain for you, they can. And if they're in a state that's favorable to tenants, then they can make pain for you that way if they're savvy. You know, the biggest problem that I've had in the past is with tenants that really know their way around the system. If they know their way around the system, they can screw you every way but Sunday. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. I guess the key there is just to really screen your tenants. You got to do a good job knowing who your tenants are going to be.
I think you screen them by how much money they give you.
Right.
I really think that's the key. It's the more money they give you, the more likely it is they're going to be good payers because they've got that money at risk. And if they have, you know, if they just squeak and buy and they just barely have enough money, that's maybe why Nina has a higher eviction rate, because people don't have that much to lose. You know, they know that, look, she's going to evict me. I'm going to, if I'm paying the same as I pay with rent for my lease option fee, then I would have lost my deposit anyway if I defaulted. So I haven't lost anything extra than I would have lost. But if I paid $5,000 or, you know, five times my amount of my monthly rent, I had a lot more to lose, and it's a lot less likely that I'm gonna default. So that, and this also goes with the people that are gonna exercise their options. The people that exercise the options are the ones that pay, you know, 3, 4, 5% or more for the property. You know, $5,000 is usually where I see that more likely. It goes well above 50% of those people are going to exercise their option. Anything below $5,000, you know, it's less than 40-50% that are going to exercise their option. So you can choose what type of tenant you want by how much money you get from them. But sometimes you're in a situation where, hey, does it make sense to do? You know, I had a student. He's been in my mentor program now for like 3 weeks. He's done two deals now. He made $1,500 on each deal. Yeah, he knew it was a little less than he could have made, but he just wanted. I told him, I said, just get your first deal done, because once you get your first deal done, you understand how this process works. So he did it. He made $3,000 in 2 weeks. He's thrilled. Because that's good money. I mean, that's still good money. And he knows that he can duplicate it over and over again. And as he gets better at it, he's going to make more money on those deals. But those aren't also, he's not on the deed of those. He did that for somebody else. He did that for rent method. So he doesn't have to worry about whether they are evicted or not. And if they do get evicted, then he could go back to that seller could come back to him and say, hey, will you find me somebody else? As long as you keep a good relationship with them, they'll usually do that. And you can make more money. Does that answer it?
Yeah. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Good. And Ben, did that get yours covered too?
Well, we got the part with qualifying the people better, but something else that just came up was the keeping the documents separate. You know, I've got a lease option, and then I have a lease agreement, and then I also have a purchase agreement, and do we want to tie them together? You know, like one document I have, like this house is being leased per lease option agreement.
You're using my contracts, right?
Yes.
Okay, so there's an option agreement, and that's attached to a purchase agreement. The purchase agreement determines the terms of the sale. The option tells you how long the option to buy that sale is good for. And then you have the lease agreement. And all these things are connected by verbiage, saying that these are all connected. If you default on one, you default on all of them. And then you also have the disclosure statement, which you want to have in there too, so everybody understands what's going on in the deal, that they've done their own inspection, they've done their own title search, they've done their own estimate of value, that they're not counting on you for those things. Also, that if they're doing a subject to, they understand what a subject to is.
Hello?
Yes. Yeah, I've done that. Yeah, I've added that in with the disclosure. The other thing I added in was lead paint, that little booklet that the federal government puts out, and you can give those for free or get them for free and pass those off.
Sure.
So I'm trying to, but anyway, we physically, or by verbiage, we do want to tie each document to the other two or three documents, correct?
Correct.
Okay. I wanted to make sure because I wasn't quite sure how we did that.
Yeah. I mean, if you read through the documents, you'll see how they're connected. Just
right.
read through them, and you'll get a feel for how they're connected already.
Yes, and I've done that, and I had one person that had, we were all the way going through, and then they just couldn't come up with the money, so I went ahead and just kept them out of the lease option program and let them rent it for about 6 months, and then they're going to get back in the first. We had to strike all that stuff from the lease agreement.
Right, right. That's not a big deal. I mean, just put it in later when they're ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, we'll add that back. So.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right, if we have time, we'll come back for more questions. I'm not sure how much time we're going to have, but we'll do it.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
The next one question here I have is from Bill Cousins. Bill, are you on the line?
Yeah.
All right, do you want me to read this here?
Yeah, go ahead. You can read it.
Okay. What do you do when you find a buyer for a house you have under contract for an option memo signed for, and the seller tells you that the people you're trying to get into it are not of the correct race? Well, you tell them to go screw themselves because that's against the law. That's against the law.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you don't even want to work with those kind of people.
No. Yeah. I just wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
Yeah. I mean, most people are smart enough not to do that stuff anymore. Even the biggest bigots around are not don't say that kind of stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm. Because I've had some people, I've had some buyers tell me that they, you know, I don't want, you know, when I'm trying to find a house for them, I don't want to be in this area and that, you know.
Yeah, well, one of the things you can say to buyers is say, look, you know, you pick the area you want to be in, tell me where you want to be, and we'll help you find it. I can't, you know, as far as race goes or community or whatever you want, you choose where you're comfortable with. Everybody's going to be more comfortable in some areas than others. You choose where you're comfortable. Personally, I think it's all about economics, not about the race. You want to be in an area that you're comfortable
right.
with economically. But, you know, if you've got some big thing about some race that you don't want to be around them, well, you know, it's pathetic, but there are people that are like that. And, you know, if they're willing to buy a property from you, does that mean you don't sell to them? I'll sell them the property.
I just would hate to have, like, a deal all ready to go and then, you know, have somebody say, oh, no, I don't want you to put them in there.
Yeah. Well, don't work with the seller like that. Don't work
with
the seller.
Yeah, but, I mean, what if they tell you that at the very last minute or something, you know?
Well, my experience has been that if you have a seller who doesn't want to sell, then you won't get the deal closed. But and I haven't experienced this, by the way, but I think that if I did experience it, I think I would go to the buyer and say, they don't want to sell to you because you're this race.
Right.
You know?
And which would get them in a lot of trouble.
Oh, big time.
Right.
because I think it's a nasty thing to do. I think it's, you know, it's reprehensible, and they need a lesson. They have a lesson they need to learn.
Can I interject here a second, Judge?
Sure.
If you already have the house under contract or whatever, then the seller's got no say in what you're going to do anyway.
Yeah,
that's true.
Well, that's the theory. That's the theory.
I knew what the answer was. I just wanted to hear it from you guys.
Yeah. If you've got a property under contract, you have the right to buy that property. You have the right to follow the terms of that property.
Yeah.
But if you have a seller who doesn't want to sell, he's got to sign that deed. And if he doesn't sign that deed, you can sue him. You can do a less pendants on him. You can do all sorts of things. But is it worth it under the kind of deals that we're doing here? Now, if it was a deal that had lots and lots of equity in it and you had a lot of money tied up in it, boy, I'd be suing like crazy. But if it's a deal like this, you just walk away from these because you don't lose anything except your time, and it's frustrating and these things happen and you're gonna lose some deals.
Plus, you feel bad, you know, kind of for the people that are all excited because they think they're getting in the house.
Absolutely, but you find them another property.
Yeah,
you can get them another property.
Yeah,
you know, one of the things that. That Nina talks about, is credit. She doesn't talk about race, but a lot of people feel really bad about the fact that they have bad credit. And her thing is, look, you are not your credit. And she knows personally. I mean, this is a woman that was in a coma for months, and then wasn't able to pay all the medical bills, and she was in a coma because the doctor, you know, left something inside her during a surgery. You know,
right.
So. I mean, she loses 6 or 8 months of her life just, you know, being out, completely out. And then she comes back and everybody, she owes money to everybody. So her credit's trashed. Does that make her trash? Of course not.
Well, that's what I've been telling people, you know, when they, I ask them, you know, how's your credit, you know, and they, well, you know, and they feel bad. And I say, hey, my credit's bad too.
Yeah.
And I said, that's how I started this business. I just tell them that and they feel a lot better.
Well, I mean, that's why I tell my story so often, because I think it helps people to hear this kind of stuff. I mean, I went through that hard time myself, and I think a lot of us have. And it's not a fun thing to go through. It's embarrassing. Does that make you garbage? No, it just makes you more understanding. It makes you more empathetic of people that have gone through it or going through it.
Yeah, true.
Hey, Joe.
Well, we're plugging away here. Yep.
Joe?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Hi, it's Peter in San Francisco. I wonder if you could give me an idea when you're going to talk about what you need to bring to the buying event this weekend.
Okay, you know, I did that I think you missed the early call, Peter.
But the early call?
Yeah, we had a call at 2 hours ago. But I'll go over it real quick before we go.
Actually, I thought it was on this.
No, this is the cash flow members call. You missed the mentor call.
Oh, shoot, I got confused.
That's all right. We can talk later if you want to, because I need to talk to you anyway.
Okay.
Okay.
Joe.
Yes.
Hey, it's Bill again real quick. Is there still room for that?
Yes, we still have room in there. Yeah, which we have a fairly small group.
Get the money together here.
Yeah. It's going to be a fun event.
All these deals stewing, but nothing has come through yet. I got one that's hopefully going to go through here real soon, but it's just, God, I don't know how people do this part-time. I mean, it's taken up my whole life.
Yeah, yeah. You just need to learn how to tweak the process so that it comes together. And sometimes when getting the first one or two done is the hardest process to make that happen.
I got a ton of stuff on the verge, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing's really.
Well, it might make sense for you to get going, get involved.
What was that?
That's some wind chimes in the background or something.
What were you saying? It might make sense to do what?
Might make sense to get involved with us so we can help you through the process.
Oh, I want to, majorly. Yeah. I just need to come up with that down payment.
Right, yes. Right. Only down payment in my program.
Yeah.
Oh, well. All right, well, let me know if you want to get involved. If anybody wants to get involved, just let me know. I'll be happy to.
As soon as I can, I'll call you.
Okay.
Right.
It's a really interesting program, by the way. The stuff that we're doing with the group and what we're doing this weekend, for those of you who are interested, we get together. I call them the buying events, and I bring all the six-month mentor students together, and we come into a room and we buy properties. We're doing the for rent method, and we're going to buy properties, and they're going to do it right there in the room. And usually we have a pretty high success rate of people, being able to get properties right then and there. We also are going to be talking about the auction process that we're working on and all the new stuff we're doing with the auctions. That is a very cool process. And we're going to be talking about Jimmy's Dream Home program, which he's kind of modified a lot of the things that we're doing, and he's come up with some really neat ideas. I'm sure you guys have seen some of the emails I've sent out of properties that he and I had for sale that you could buy. And so we're selling them to rent-to-buy people, then we're turning around selling them to investors as well. So we get money on that part, we get money on the lease option part, we get money from the investor, we get money from the lender, and we get money from the real estate agent that's involved. So we're able to make it possible for the lease option buyers to actually go out and pick a property from the MLS and buy them. It's really cool. It's really cool. So we're going to get into that in a lot of detail, and then we're going to talk about the experience Bob Bowman and I had down in Florida last weekend with that $1 million auction. It was quite a interesting process. We had some struggles, but interesting process. All right, let's go into the next. I think the last question I have here is from Mark Idzik. Mark, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Joe.
Okay, great. You want to summarize the question for me?
I've sent several, so I'm not sure which one it is, but I'd be glad to.
Pick two, and then if we have time, we'll come back for more.
Wonderful. The first one is basically how to credit a larger deposit amount on a rent-to-own option to a buyer. For example, I know $2,000 or $3,000 is easy to add to the end, as you mentioned, to the purchase price. It's when it's like $5,000 or $10,000 and the seller is already has had it a little bit over market. Adding an additional $10,000 sounds to me as it would make it too high.
Well, typically you can sell a rent-to-buy property for about 10% over its real market value.
Okay.
So if you've got a property that's worth $100,000, to get $105,000, $110,000 for it, it's not unusual with a rent-to-buy. So as long as the seller's not totally out of range with what they want, for you to tack on the extra money is not going to be that difficult.
And if they've already added the 5 or 10 onto it, and then my adding $5,000 or $10,000.
Then it could be a problem. That's why you want to tell the seller you can't sell it for more than it's worth.
Right.
You know, all you're going to get is what it's worth, and I can get you that or something really close to it, but I can't get you more than that. So you have that's where you come in with your negotiating and to try to get them to be reasonable on their price.
Because
if they went out and sold it with a real estate agent, how much are they going to get? Well, they're not going to get this much. Or maybe even if they did get this much, how much is it going to cost them to sell it with a realtor in another 7, 8, 9, 10% to sell it with a realtor? Plus, they're going to negotiate and all this other stuff. These people that are coming in, your buyers that are coming in, are not going to be negotiating.
Understand. Got it. Okay.
So,
excellent.
Okay.
Mike. And then the other one, I appreciate that. Then the second one was, it's kind of a follow-up, was where on a lot of the buyers that I've been talking to want to set the price of the home to be by appraisal at a mutually agreed upon appraised price at the time of the end of the option or whenever they exercise. I wondered how that, if that works, and what, how I could, you know, work in the deposit and things like that.
Oh, you're in Arizona, right? So you're in a,
yes,
a rapidly appreciating market.
Yes.
There's a couple of things that we're doing. Bob, are you still on the line, Bob Bowman?
Yes, sir.
You want to tell them what you're doing? Because you're in that kind of a market.
Well,
tell them about the stair step thing that you did with the 90 day and the 120 days and all that stuff.
Okay, a couple things. I'll talk about that. But what I try to do is avoid that situation. I explain to them to put yourself in the buyer's shoes. We're going to ask them to put down a non-refundable deposit to buy the house on a price that they don't even know what it is. And if you could put yourself in their shoes, Mr. Seller, you know, you might be uncomfortable with that as well. So what I'd like to do is let's determine a price that makes you happy, that is still marketable today. So let's set the price, and if you get that price, you're feeling good about it, and see if we can, you know, stick with that. Now, if they still insist on some kind of appraisal at the end of the process, I'll still try to avoid that. At a minimum, if they're going to insist on appraisal, and nobody ever has, actually, by the time I'm done talking to them, but it has to be two independent appraisers, one that the buyer gets, one that the seller gets, and you take the average. But, again, I've never had that situation where they push that point. What I'll finally say to them, if it is an appreciating market, and the stair-step approach, is that we'll have more than one sell price. So, in other words, if they close within the first 6 months, we'd sell it for $350,000. If they close months 7 through 12, it'd be $360,000 or something along that line. I have one where I even had three different closing prices. It was, I can't remember the numbers. It was $350,000 the first 6 months, $360,000 the second 3 months after that, and $370,000 the third 3 months. So you don't really need to make it that complicated, but usually if you just suggest to them that you can have two prices, one if they close the first half of the year and one in the second half of the year, that should satisfy my experience.
Okay. Okay, I appreciate that.
Okay.
By the way, everybody, we can hear everything you do in the background.
Everything.
Star 6, man, before you go to the bathroom. Oh, boy.
That reminded me of Mike Myers' movie.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, Mark, does that answer the question?
It does. I just had a lot of most of the sellers. In fact, I've been having trouble convincing. I don't know if it's convincing is the right word, but I'm having trouble getting sellers, even though there are so many homes in the area available. The sellers are just avoiding trying to fix a price and actually sign the memo. They're kind of avoiding both of those situations.
Well, I think that one part of this is about how you negotiate. Bob's working in a market that's appreciating, what, 20-30% a year?
Yeah, last year it was 36%.
36% a year.
Wow.
So it's just a matter of being able to talk to these people. Like, Bob is good. You know, he's been doing this for a while. But he got good because he's been doing it for a while. He's
right.
Got good because he's
just keep doing it, right?
Just keep doing it. And you help them, you know, you look at what they're saying and say, well, what can I say to them to make it work? Or what other options do they have? And if they have other options, then maybe it makes sense for them to go with those other options. Now, a lot of people, if you're calling the for rent guys, a lot of those guys buy those properties specifically for that reason. A lot of the leads that Bob is getting are from signs. So maybe you should be using signs out there to bring in your leads.
And for home sellers?
Right.
For renters.
Right.
Landlords. Okay.
Right. You know, I'll make an offer on your home today. And your phone.
Okay.
And
really?
Yeah. You know, just put those signs out, and I mean, Bob, that's where a lot of your leads are coming from, aren't they?
Yeah, almost all my leads. Yeah.
Yeah. So
well, that is right, because that's backwards. Because I'm basically contacting people that are renting their own homes.
Right. Right. And some of those people are. It's going to be determined by the motivation of those people. So I think I would switch over and do a voice blast to those people, and. Maybe try it that way. I think I'd also be looking at auctions in those high-end areas because we're having some success with those as well, making the auctions work in the higher-end properties areas.
Okay. Awesome. Because the market has slowed down here. It's kind of, it was appreciating really quickly for the last 2 years. Now it's pretty much now it's split to be more of a, you know, there's like 25,000 homes available versus 5,000 homes available last time this year. So.
Well, that's the perfect argument with the landlords.
Right, exactly. That's why I'm switching to now saying that same thing as, you know, we have a unique opportunity here, so.
Right.
Okay. Well, Mark, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
What you might want to start doing, too, you'll see a lot of articles written about the bubble bursting or at least the steam being let out, and I'm starting to capture some of those. I've got a Money Magazine article talking about the properties being worth less 12 months from now than they are now. So you might argue with your folks in Arizona, they maxed out. Now's the time
right.
to lock in the price, you know, and let's not be picky about it.
Sure. No, that makes absolute sense. I appreciate
that's
that.
That's a great argument.
So that is.
You better catch it before they start dropping. You can lock this in.
Right, because I agree. I feel that same way. I feel that they are going to be dropping. So.
I don't think we're going to see the bubble burst as much as we as everybody was thinking it was going to be. I think we're going to see a leveling off, though. And a stagnation eventually, and I'm hoping we don't see the drop. But I've been predicting the drop for a while, and I'm wondering now. You know, who knows? But because the market has changed, a lot of things have changed in the world.
Yeah,
that's having an impact.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for the input.
You bet.
Okay, Eric. Can I get a quick question in?
Sure.
I'm trying to get, well, I'm very green at this. I just ordered the books online.
What's your name?
I'm trying to get started.
What's your name? Hello? What's your name?
Eric Bonsu in Laurel, Maryland, Joe.
Okay, Eric, okay.
Yes, I've even done my first 1 year. I've been reading the books and trying to get, you know, become very knowledgeable.
Okay.
Is there like a one-stop website that will give me comps, tell me, you know, the cost of a house, the value of a house? So I'll know what I'm looking at for the places that I go to.
There are websites that claim to do that, but I haven't found one that's national yet that has all the different places. A lot of the times, like if you're in California, DataQuick has all the tax records online, and you can you know buy their service and get online with them. If you're in different states that have their tax records online and their taxes are based on the sale price, so that information would be online. In Indiana, the tax records that on that level are not online because taxes aren't based on sale price. So you have to get your comps from the MLS, but the MLS is proprietary with realtors, so you have to get them from realtors to do that. So what you need to look for, and I think do you know first of all if your tax records are online?
I have no idea.
What state are you in?
Maryland.
Maryland?
Yes.
They might be online. So the way you'd find out is you call either a realtor or the title company and ask them, you know, where are comps? I'm trying to find comps on property to find out what the value of a property is. Where can I get comps? Can I get them from the tax record, or do I have to get them from the MLS?
Okay.
And they'll tell you, you know, and if there's tax record, they probably have, title company will have access to them because they'll have access to all the title work. But if they don't, if it's not, then the title company may not have access to them. Some MLSs allow title companies to have access to them. Some of them don't. You know, so they may have it or they may not. If they don't, then you have to go to a real estate agent and ask them for the information. But also remember, you don't have to spend a whole lot of time doing comps.
Okay.
You know, the way we're structuring deals here, you know, you're not putting any money up. You're not putting any credit on the line. And you've got them contingent upon finding a buyer. So if you don't have a buyer in place before you close, then you don't have to close the deal. Which means that if it's priced too high and you don't have a buyer, you can't get a buyer because it's priced too high, well, you've lost some time, but you haven't lost any money or you're not risking anything. So instead, what I suggest is just ask your buyer if they, you know, what they think the price is. And, and they're not going to be accurate. they're going to be somewhat accurate. But then you ask them, well, how did you come up with that value? And
okay.
Then, As you learn more, you're going to be able to determine whether they know what the heck they're talking about. If they say, well, the one across the street is listed for that, you know, well, that's not the value. That's what they were listed for.
Uh-huh.
You know, what did it sell for? What property sold for is what determined the value. at comparable properties. So what did it, what, you know, is there any around you that have sold for that? Or maybe they'll tell you, oh, I had an appraisal done. Well, they say it like it's written in stone that it was, came down from God himself. Well, appraisals mean nothing. Appraisals are just an opinion by somebody who is paid a fee to come up with a particular value. If I'm refinancing my home, a lot of times I'll try to get a high appraisal so I can get rid of mortgage insurance, so I can show 20% equity and get rid of my mortgage insurance. Uh-huh. So I may have an appraisal that's maybe 10-15% higher than the real value of the property. Or maybe I'm getting a divorce and I want that appraisal to come in low because I'm the one that's keeping the property and I have to give the other half the equity to my ex-wife.
Uh-huh.
You know, so that you know, then I'd want to get the low appraisal, so maybe that appraisal's way low. So you got to find out why they did the appraisal if you find out they have an appraisal. And then, if they have an appraisal, look at the appraisal to find out what the comps are on the appraisal and see if they're real comps, see if they're really comparable, or if they're in the neighborhood next to it, which is the estates section of the subdivision instead of the, you know, the country club station, you know, section of the, you know, subdivision, which they'd have different price starting points. So it wouldn't be real comparable prices. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Hey, Joe?
Okay, good. Yes.
Where does an appraiser get their comps?
An appraiser gets them from the MLS.
Because they got appraiser school right around the corner from me, and I was thinking about doing that just to get all their information on how they get prices on houses.
Well, they have to get them from the MLS, and appraisers usually can get access to the MLS. They just have to pay a fee, and then they'd be a licensed appraisal. I wouldn't screw with that. Don't spend all your time on that. Spend time on things that make you money. You know, people think, I'm going to go get my real estate license, I'm going to go get my appraisal license, I'm going to go get my home inspection license. All those things can help you, but they don't make you money. And so, or I'm going to go get my contractor's license. You know, none of that stuff is good. I mean, it's all good, but none of it's worth getting right now if you don't have it already. If you have it, use it to your benefit. If you don't have it, don't worry about it. Go make offers. Because the offers, making offers, that's what makes you money. Everybody gets screwed up with the priorities of what to do first when they're getting started in this business. Oh, I got to go get my LLC set up first, so I do this legally. Well, you can do it legally in your own name with a Schedule C. And if you don't have a whole lot of assets to lose, you know, it doesn't matter if you get sued because they can't take anything from you. So, you know, just get started by making offers. You probably make mistakes, but the type, if you do it the way I'm teaching, your risk is going to be really diminished. So a little bit of soap. So I'll get off my soapbox there. I didn't mean to lay into you like that. Does that make sense, though?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Joe.
Yes.
Hey, Joe. This is Heather in Columbus, Ohio. I just wanted to say I had one investor that said you can get free values for homes off of www.zillow, that's ZILLOW.com.
Right.
And
they're pulling it from the tech.
He said that it doesn't cover all homes,
right,
but it does cover quite a few. And
right,
I know you emphasize in all of your recordings that you really don't, or not all of your recordings, but you really don't need to know the comps.
Right.
Now, how does Bob Bowman do it in Florida with the high-end homes that he sells?
I don't get comps. I don't get comps. They go through the same process that Joe Wayne, where when I ask them how much you want for your house, I ask them how they arrived at that number, and I just get a sense that it's valid or not, you know, and maybe they had a realtor who put it on the market, or they've had some houses that sold nearby, or so I just talk with the people who I'm buying the house from, and I get a sense from that, but I don't validate that, and I have a conversation with them. I say, I don't care what anybody tells you, the reason your house is going to sell or not is price. So what you and I have to come up with is a price that you're happy with that'll still make your house attractive, particularly now in a softened market where there is a ton of inventory on the market. So what is that price? And, you know, whatever price they said, is that your bottom line? Can we even sweeten the pot better? I'm guessing that you're coming to me because you want to sell your house quickly. So let's try to do that. What's the absolute best price that you're still happy that we can get out there and get your house sold quickly? So that's the kind of conversation I'll have. And after you're in the market a while, you'll get a sense for whether it's high, low, or medium, you know. But the real true test is when folks come out there and they say, well, that's a lot higher than the other houses I've looked at, and that's what matters. and that'll be found out pretty quickly. So, yeah, I'll also quote those other statistics from Joe where I can't remember what percentage of it is, Joe, that 20-30%, whatever it is, of houses that get sold in the first 30 days, and then after 30 more days, 2-3%, another 30 days, 2-3%, and then 90 days into it, another big percentage of houses are sold. And I ask my prospects, do you know why that is? Because it wasn't priced right in the first place, and it took the sellers 90 days to realize it until they got it priced right, and they wasted all that time and lost all those prospects. So if we price it right in the first 30 days, we'll get the house sold. If we don't, we won't, period.
That's one of the most powerful arguments I ever used, because it really does help people get their properties priced properly. Because once they understand that, and I'll give you the statistics real quick again, Bob, so you know the numbers. It's 40% of the homes that sell in the MLS sell in the first 30 days. The second 30 days, only 7% sell. The third 30 days, only 7% sell. The fourth 30 days, it jumps up to 20% that sell. And that's because people lower their price after the 90 days. Really, really powerful concept.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you, Joe.
Do I have a question again?
Sure. There's some wind chimes in the background. If somebody's got those, press *6 and it'll mute you out.
Got a question about insurance, Joe.
Okay, shoot.
In a subject to deal, most often I'm finding that the people that are selling have an owner-occupied loan, and their insurance is set up that way. And I'm concerned about if I try to get insurance on the place as a non-owner-occupied, that it might, well, they contact the mortgage company, and it might cause a due-on-sale clause or send up a red flag. How do you deal with something like that?
I spent about 10 minutes on this question earlier in the call. Were you, did you just come on?
No, I got on a little bit right around 2:00.
Okay, because I spent some time on it. You might want to go back. I'm recording this, and so go back and listen to it again.
Okay.
But I'll give you the basics here. You need to get a landlord policy, and my feeling is don't worry about the due on sale clause. Just go ahead and get a landlord policy. Send a letter to the lender saying that you're now managing the property, and to send all correspondence to you, and then have it signed by the seller.
Okay, that's it, huh?
Yeah, and is there a risk that the due-on-sale clause can happen? Yes, and I kind of go into a long explanation about that. But if you don't have much equity in the property, and you don't have any money in it, you don't have any credit in it, you know, you don't have a lot to lose here. And I've never seen a due-on-sale clause exercised with a property that doesn't have a ton of equity in it. So, actually, I've never even seen it with that.
Well, I just refinanced my personal property to take out some equity, and then I ended up renting it out before the actual mortgage was processed. And in retrospect, it's like, my gosh, I ended up signing something saying that I was living there and that it was owner-occupied, and now it's not. And I don't want to, I don't know if I should try to refinance it again as not owner-occupied or...
Yeah.
As long as the payments are on time, nobody knows any of the better. But I heard that if something was to happen, say a fire or anything, that the insurance company would go to great lengths to not pay the claim because I wasn't owner occupied.
Well, what you need to do is get a landlord policy. It doesn't matter what the mortgage says. What matters is what the insurance policy says. That's why you need a landlord policy.
Well, won't they then contact the lender and say that the policy, the type of policy, has been changed?
Yeah, they'll do that. Yeah, I mean, what's worst case scenario for you is you have to sell the property,
right?
You know, you have to pay it off and you have to sell it. I seriously doubt that's going to happen. If you talk to 90% of the people that are renting their houses out, they originally bought it as a home to live in, and their agreement and renting it is different, by the way, than selling the property. If you're lease optioning it, or if you're selling on a land contract or something like that, that's actually you're transferring the property. But a lease isn't considered usually selling the property. And when you said
lease optioning,
and when you said that you and were going to owner occupy it, most of the documents say that your intention is to owner occupy. So your intention was there to owner-occupy, and that changed, your life changed, whatever. They may ask you to document that for you at one point, although I've never seen that happen. But if they do, I seriously doubt they'd foreclose on you in this situation. And if you have a question about it, just call your lender up and say, here's what happened. You know, here's what's going on. Do I have any? Is there any problem? You know, and
okay.
see what they say. They may tell you to refinance, but boy, I'd make them. I'd force them to make me.
know, all right, thank you.
I don't think I'd do it because it's too expensive. Unless you can save money on the refinance.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
You bet.
Joe.
Yes.
How do you still want again?
Hey. Okay.
I was wondering, is it okay to go into questions?
Yes, please. I kind of got into that without mentioning it, so I finished all the emails.
Oh, okay. Well, this is just a quick question. Just letting you know, I placed my rent-to-own ad in the paper.
Okay.
I'm trying to find a buyer for my seller. And I had a few phone calls that come in, and when I explained to them that, you know, the seller requires a down payment of $6,000 down, and then I tell them about the fee that I'm selling to in the property, which is $5,000 down, they tell me it's too much. So I don't know. Why am I not obtaining these buyers, and is it something, and then, you know.
Well, let me understand here. So you've got a property. How much is the property worth?
Well, this particular property, they want $295,000.
And he wants to, and you're trying to find a lease option buyer for him, right?
Yes.
You're doing the for rent method.
Yes.
Okay, so, and so he wants $295,000, and you want to make how much?
$5,000.
And the seller, though, he wants how much initially?
I'm sorry, he wants $7,000 down. This is the first month's rent plus 2 months security deposit. And he wanted the second security deposit, so in case any damages occur on the property.
That's your problem.
Oh.
That's your problem.
Okay.
Because I don't think you'd have any problem getting your $5,000 in the first month's rent.
Mm-hmm.
But your seller's asking for too much.
I've been running into a couple of these sellers that's requiring that.
Tell them no.
Okay.
Tell them, look, if you go out and find a tenant, and you can do this in the nicest possible way, you know, obviously you don't use that attitude.
Well, I would.
Ask them, okay, here's a situation. You've got a property. You're trying to get a tenant in there. You're trying to get it sold. You're paying a monthly payment on that, I assume, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how much are you paying every month? You know, you've got, you know, maybe $2,000 a month, $1,800 a month, something like that. What's their payment, do you know?
He's asking, I don't have the paper on me. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I believe he's asking $1,800 a month.
Okay. So if it takes him, you know, 2 months, it's $3,600. If it takes him 3 months to rent it, it's more. So he's got does it make sense to wait for a tenant that's going to pay more to him and then pay it out of his pocket to make those mortgage payments? Or does it make more sense to go directly from you, who can put something together much quicker, but, you know, he won't get a deposit? The deposit he has to give back to that tenant anyway when they're done, you know, and there is some security, because even though they're not giving the money to him, they're giving it to you, so they've got money coming out of their pocket. And because they're a lease option buyer, there's some other advantages than just having a tenant. First of all, they're going to take care of the property if you use my contracts. Furnace breaks down, they have to take care of it. You know, if the roof leaks, they have to take care of it. Nobody's calling them in the middle of the night. Nobody's calling the seller in the middle of the night to come unclog the toilet if they use this process. So I think that's what you're trying to – you need to help them see the value of working with you. You need to help them see the value that, hey, I've got – how many people you got on your list right now? Buyers.
I had five, and they all were turned off by the amount. It was too steep.
No. How many total people on your buyers list right now? Not just people that are interested in this property, but all your buyers.
Oh, now I'm down to zero.
Okay. Once you get started, you'll never be down to zero.
Okay.
Because I don't care if they're 5 years old.
Okay.
They're still leads in your system. And you can always call them back later. So you got to keep these lists. You got to build this list. So if you have a list, let's say you put out 10 signs that say rent to buy, and these signs cost you $2 a piece. You make them out of cardboard and you handwrite rent to buy homes, you know, and your phone number. You're going to get a lot of calls. You're going to build that up to 30, 50, 100 people really quick. I mean, within weeks.
Okay.
You're going to have buyers in place ready to go. Now, when you go to a seller and say, look, I've got 63 people on my list or 23 people on my list that are interested in buying a property in this area, but I don't have any properties to sell to them. And they all need to be rent to buy. They're good people, but they have some credit issues or some income, you know, verification issues. They can all come up with down payments, which, you know, which is how I get paid, and then they pay monthly to you. Would something like this make sense to you? You know, it's hard. These guys are out here advertising for buyers for their, or renters for their property. You think they're not going to be interested in a list of 63 people or 23 people that are already in place? They're going to be they're going to just jump at that. And your credibility is instantly goes through the roof because you've got what they need. They don't care that you don't have any experience, if you've never done this before. You've got 63 people on your list. And it cost, that list cost you maybe $50 to create.
It's just so hard to get past a security deposit all in one.
No, Lana, you're going the wrong direction with this.
Okay.
And you're just going the wrong direction with this because you're trying to get them to do something. And you say, this is how I work. Do you
right.
want my buyers?
Okay.
You know, you can go out and get your own buyers. How long is it going to take you to get them? If you don't get them, you know I'm still around, so just give me a call. And then you put them in a follow-up system.
Okay.
Don't take deals that you can't do.
Okay.
You know, don't, I mean, unless you just want to get a sign in the yard and help you build your buyers list. You know, do you have a sign in the guy's yard right now?
No, actually, I placed an ad in the paper, too.
Why don't you have a sign in his yard?
I didn't think about doing that.
No, that's the very first thing you do as soon as you get this lease option thing done.
Okay.
Because that's the most likely thing to get a lease option buyer for that particular property is a sign in the yard.
Okay.
So you get that sign in the yard, and you'll build a buyer's list pretty quickly. And you put 10 other signs all around that neighborhood that say the same thing and have point arrows pointing to this house.
Okay.
These signs, and by the way, these signs are really cheap. You go to Walmart, and you get yellow cardboard, what is that stuff called? The
poster board,
yeah, and thick black marker, and you write on there rent to buy in the ugliest writing you can do, and you don't put anything else on there. It's a rent to buy, no qualifying phone number. Move in today if you want to on there, and then maybe an arrow pointing toward the direction that you know leads to the house, or just put them around the community, and you'll get people from the community that are interested in opting into your list. Having that opt-in list, now it gives you enormous, enormous leverage. And for you, for those of you who have listened to Jim Drayle's talk about, you know, building credibility, that audio tape that I sent out to all you guys that were on the list at the time, I'm not sure what month that was, but he talks about how that builds your credibility. And it really, really, really works. It really works.
So just to get an understanding, so basically, I just need to find a buyer that can come up with $3,600 down to the seller plus my fee. Am I on the right track? Or
what you want to do, what you want to try to negotiate with your seller is 1 month's rent, and that's all they're coming in with. And tell them that they're going to pay you the lease option fee. That's how you get paid in the transaction.
Oh, I see.
Now, some people, and Jim included, he goes ahead and if they ask for a security deposit, he goes ahead and gives them that out of his lease option fee.
Oh, okay.
So he, you know, that, so let's say it's $1,800 for the first month's rent, $1,800 for the security deposit, and the most they can come up with is $5,000 plus $1,800.
Mm-hmm.
Which you think you could find somebody like that?
What's
the most that somebody's been able to come up with that you've found so far?
Maybe like $4,000.
Okay, so with $4,000, they're not going to be able to do this property. That means they can't afford $1,800 a month.
Right. Yeah.
You got to find somebody who can afford that kind of property. But anybody that can afford $1,800 a month, more than likely is going to be able to come up with another $1,800 and some money on top of that. You got to decide what's the minimum profit that you're willing to make. You know, if they only came up with $1,000 more than that, would that be acceptable? Well, maybe for your first deal it would be. Maybe that would make sense. So you just go for it. And so you take the 1,800 plus you take 18 to the security deposit, and then another 1,000. So, and then you can work it out with the seller that when that deal closes, that the $1,800 deposit comes back to you. You could write that into the contract.
Okay.
You know, so okay, look, I'll give you the deposit. Try to negotiate so you don't have to give that away, because every dollar you give away is a dollar out of your pocket. So try to negotiate it. But maybe when you're just starting, it's easier to say, okay, I'll give you that, give you what you want, and you know, just give it back to me later, and see if you can negotiate it that way.
Okay.
You can also go to these buyers and say, okay, you've got 5,000 now. You need, you know, 7,000. Go ahead and let's get you moved in with the 5,000. You know, I'll give the guy what he needs. I'll only make 1,000 on this. But you're also the buyer. You know, I want you to pay me $500 a month for the next 6 months to pay the rest of your lease option fee. Can you do that?
Okay.
And see if they can come up with it. Or if it's not 500, can they pay 200 for 12 months?
Okay.
You know, or 100 for 2 years. You know, anything to just keep increasing that income that you're getting from these people. And every time you do this, once you get one of these done, you'll look at it and say, okay, you know, I could have gotten more money if I'd done this. And,
right.
And all that matters is you make, just go make $500. And then next time you'll say, well, how can I turn that into $1,000 next time? You know, if I negotiated a little better on this end, on the seller, if I negotiated a little bit better on the buyer, if I, you know, made some terms here, if I was able to get the deposit, you know, if I was able to get some money from the mortgage broker. I mean, there's lots of places to make money here.
Okay.
So where can you make the money? And each time you do this, you're going to get better so that your average income per deal is going to increase as you get better at this. But the first thing is just to do one so you know you can do it.
I see.
Because that's where you're having your biggest problem is your confidence that you can pull it off. And
yeah.
You know, you're coming back to this, well, nobody will do this. Nobody will do this. Nobody will do that. And that's not true.
Okay.
Because it's the way you're presenting it to them that's making them say no. Or it's the type of deal that you're putting together that's not working.
That security deposit part that's not working. That's what it's been.
Yeah, yeah. So change it.
Okay.
Change it.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah, don't unless the only reason to do that deal with him is to get a sign in the yard. But you don't even have a sign in the yard. If you had
right.
a sign. I mean, sometimes it makes sense to do stupid deals that you know you'll never close just because you want a sign in the yard to build your list.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you get that sign in the yard, that's the next step. That's going to make it easier to do the next deal.
Okay.
And once you have a sign in the yard and they're talking to you and you're telling them, oh, the price is too high, the price is too high. We need to drop this. We need to drop this. Are you ready to drop it yet? Are you ready? You know, next week goes by. Are you ready to drop it yet? A lot of times they'll drop it. So sometimes you can get them into the process by accepting what they want and then getting them to drop later on. Just stay on top of them and keep reminding them why it's not selling. It's not your fault. It's not you that's keeping that property from selling. If that property was a good deal, and it made sense, then somebody would have bought it already.
But, you know, these homes are new construction. Well,
it doesn't matter how nice the property is or how terrible it is.
Okay.
What matters is it a good deal?
Okay.
Is it the right type of deal? Is it something that will work? If it's not a deal that will work, it doesn't matter how nice it is or how terrible it is, it's not going to work. And vice versa, if it's a good deal, it doesn't matter how terrible it is or how good it is, it's going to work.
Now let the seller know.
Okay.
Hey, Joe, can I ask one more question?
Thank you.
You bet, Kwana. Good luck.
Okay.
Hey, Joe?
Yes. Who's this?
Do I have time for one more question?
Yes. Yes, who is
okay.
it? Who's this?
In the process where you have your prospective buyer go out and find houses for you to that he likes, could you step through that process of how that occurs and how you eventually go out and contact the seller of that house to structure the deal?
Well, one of the things that we're using is a series of emails that go out, sent out by an autoresponder, which you guys may not be set up for. But if you have some web savvy and you know how to use autoresponders, this is a very powerful tool because once they opt into your list, then you have a whole series. I have a whole series of things that I have people, hoops that I have them jump through. And the more they do it, the more they qualify for it. But I also educate them about the process. I educate them about the benefits of owning a home and buying on a lease option and the things that we can do for them. And then I send an email that tells them about, hey, you can also find your own property. All you have to do is go look through the properties that are for rent, or if you're driving down the street and you see one that's for rent, you know, get the information on it. And if you like it, give me a call, and I'll try to set up a deal on it. And I'll you know, because I know how to set them up as rent to buy. And I can put the deal together for you, and then you know, you'll pay me a lease option fee. So that's how you do it. And it's not rocket science. I mean, it's just a matter of telling them to do it. If they start to talk to the buyer, the sellers, it's going to be harder for you to negotiate the deal. So you want to tell them, don't, you know, if you talk to the sellers, it'll be harder for me to help you. You'll have to do it on your own. But if you just get the information, let me call them. I can usually put it together for you. And you'll be able to do it maybe 50% of the time. So tell them, you know, get three or four of them. And it's likely that out of those, we'll be able to get one of them together.
And then you just structure the deal like you normally would.
Yeah, just like a regular lease option memo, you know, deal, the for rent deals, where they take a lease option memo from the seller, and then you assign your right to that lease option to the new buyer. And you take the lease option fee as your assignment fee.
Okay, I have one additional question that kind of goes tails on to the end of that, and that is, I know that Jim Drell talks about getting an upfront front fee. How can you do that and not look like a buyer's agent?
Well, he's talking about the Dream Home program, right?
Right.
Yeah, the Dream Home program is they're buying from you, so you're not an agent anymore. What you're doing is what he's doing with that is. He put out an offer. He sent out to his list and said, "Look, if you give me $6,000, I'll connect you up with my real estate agent. He will go through the MLS with you and help you find a property. And when you find that property, I'll buy it for you and I'll lease option it to you."
Okay.
Okay. So he's not working as an agent on any level here. As a matter of fact, the agent that he is using to help find the property is going to give him back 50% of the commission. Which actually is perfectly legal in, for the a seller or for an agent to rebate a buyer part of the commission, which is what would be happening in this situation. And then Jim doesn't close the deal. He sells it to another investor. He tries to negotiate as low a price as he can on it, and he sells it for more than the asking price. So he tries to get $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 of equity in the property. So it makes a lot of sense for an investor to come in and say, yeah, I'll come in with my 10% down, get a new loan, and buy this property. That way I don't have to do anything. I've already got a tenant in place who's going to buy it in a year. I'm going to make, you know, $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 in a year. Plus, I'm going to get the tax benefits of this. And if you set it up, I mean, we're even going as far as showing them how to do self-directed retirement programs. So this makes a lot of sense for somebody who's got some money they need to protect. And but even for people that just want to make, you know, an extra 10 or 15 or 20 grand a year, just buy one property, and they don't have to find the property, they don't have to find the tenant, they don't have to do the management, they don't have to do anything except they have to just qualify for a loan and maybe put 10% down. So they have to have a little bit of money. And some of these we're actually getting for lower down payments than that. But it's a kind of a no-brainer for everybody. Plus, plus Jim's making all his money, and he hasn't ever found a property. He didn't have to buy a property. He didn't have to sell a property. All he had to do was use his list creatively. It's brilliant. It's brilliant stuff.
Hey, Joe, can I ask you a question?
Yep. You bet.
Nina was talking about foreclosures, and if people were late on their payments, there's a form or something where she would have it tied to the back end of the loan. How would you do that?
I'm not sure I understand what you're talking about. So something on something that she bought or something she sold?
Something that she's buying. She's getting somebody out of foreclosure.
Okay.
They're 2 months late on their payments.
Okay.
And said she would negotiate or do something with the bank, and there was some form or something that I don't know if she had the owners fill out, and somehow I attached it to the back end of the loan or something like that.
Right. What she needs to do, what you need to do is get like a power of attorney where the lender will, where it allows you to talk to the lender on the behalf of the borrower. And by doing that, then she can call up the loss mitigation department and say, hey, I faxed over that form. Did you get it? It says it's okay for you to talk to me. And say, oh, yeah, we got it. Here's what we'd like to do. I want to buy this property. Would you take the money that they owe and put it on the back of this? I'll make the payments, and I'm going to rent the property out. Would you guys have a problem with that? And a lot of times they'll say no, and they'll do it because they don't want another black mark on their books. You know, banks have credit ratings just like people. And if they get a bad credit rating, and they get bad credit ratings by having non-performing loans. So when they have a non-performing loan, that's a real negative for them. So if they can get it to perform again, it makes them look a lot better. And if they feel comfortable that you're going to make those payments to them, a lot of times they'll do that. Not every time, though. You need to talk to them.
So does the bank know then it's basically a subject to loan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean,
thank you.
Yeah, they, as long as, or she could approach him as the management company and say, look, we're going to make payments. You know, I've got a tenant in here. We're going to put a tenant in here. You could do it that way too, I guess. But I don't, I just tell them what's happening. I don't see any reason to try to pull the wool over their eyes. Just tell them what's happening. If they don't like it, I mean, you haven't lost anything. And you still might be able to do the deal if you get enough money as a lease option fee up front to bring them current.
Right.
You just don't make any money up front. You make it on the back end.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Joe.
Yes.
You know, Ben Arnold.
Hey, Ben.
Hi. On Awesome's CD, he was talking about not liking lease options because they appear to be difficult to close out the option holder or the buyer when, and I'm assuming that's when they become credit worthy. And what kind of problems is he talking about, or can you provide some more insight into what he's seeing?
Well, somebody earlier on the call said that they had a lender who said they could do any kind of loan. And these are the kind of loans that would be really nice to have a lender that could do any kind of loan do, because it would make life so much easier. If you could do a lease option to somebody and sell a property for 10% over market value and then have them cashed out within 6 months because the guy can do a loan with anybody, you could make your money a lot quicker. And that'd be really nice. But when people have bad credit, it sometimes takes a while for them to get their credit in order again so that they can get a loan. First of all, they have to have income, enough income to support it, and their income may or may not support it, and they may be counting on it going up within that year period. And if it didn't go up, then they can't support it, or they may have taken on more debt. Maybe they got a bad credit car loan, and they took on more debt, and it keeps them from being able to have the debt ratios they need in order to qualify for the loan. Or maybe they had some negative on their credit that just needs more time to come off of there, or to not have an impact with the lender. You know, maybe it's some 30 days lates that are only 5 months old or 6 months old, and they want more seasoning on those lates. Or maybe they had a bankruptcy, but it was 18 months ago, and the bank wants 2 years before that happens. Or maybe they had a foreclosure, and the bank wants 3 years on a foreclosure. You know, foreclosure is probably the worst thing that can happen if you're trying to get a loan on your credit. Does that answer the question?
I guess. I thought there was something more to it. I understood that part. I guess maybe it makes some sense to try and do a little bit of minor credit counseling, if you will, to the people that are in the properties, just to say, you know, keep your nose clean and let's not add any more debt, things like that, and try and work it through that way.
Right. And does that mean that they'll do what you say?
Probably not.
Yeah, probably not, yeah. But they might. And if they do, then great. And a lot of people, you know, they're going through a tough time and they'll solve the problem. And other people, they won't be able to solve the problem in that amount of time. But the people, and that's why I always say that the more money they put down as a lease option fee, the more likely it is and the harder they'll work to make it work. To get their credit in order, to get everything in, get all their ducks in a row so they can buy that property, because they know they're going to lose that money if they don't.
Right.
So,
okay, thank you.
So I think that's where Osmond's frustration came from. You know, he just didn't want to screw with the tenants. You know, you have to put new people in there. Nina sees it a completely different way. Now, she's still struggling trying to get people financed, but in the meantime, she's making income. She's getting cash flow from them.
Mm-hmm.
Osmond doesn't think it's worth it to make that small amount of cash flow. So everybody's got a different personality about that type of thing.
Joe?
Yes.
One thing I haven't heard anybody say is, you know, when that lease option expires, you can always do another lease option with that same tenant.
Exactly, yeah. You get another lease option fee. And as a matter of fact, I think that's the first thing that you want to try. You try and you say, look, you are not able to do it for this year. Do you want to go ahead and put another lease option fee down and keep it for another year? And see if they can come up with it. Well, I can only come up with half of what I came up with last time. Would you do that? Oh, yeah, why not? You know, as long as you're making income on the thing, you know, it's going up in value, and you might as well do it. If it's gone up, you know, if it's gone up 40% in value or something like that, and you can make a lot more money by getting rid of them, then you have to decide. You know, it's kind of then it becomes sort of a moral issue. You know, what's the right thing to do?
Jump
right.
Yes.
Joe, this is Mark in Arizona again. Have you run into situations where you, on the rent-to-own option that you have sellers that you contact, you have a memo with, and then I find out that they're also renting the property through a realtor, and then when I contact them, they're basically saying, well, if I get you something from you first, then I'll take yours, and if I get something from them, I'll take theirs. But it seems to impede on being able to show the property and putting a sign up.
Right. If you can't get a sign in the yard and you're trying to do a lease option, I'd say don't do it.
Okay.
You know, I've gone around and around with these types of things before, and if they won't work with you on that level, it's going to be difficult to get the thing done. I just wouldn't mess with it. You know, don't take any deal just because it's a deal. You know, make sure you get at least something. You're going to get something out of the deal if you're going to put the time in, and the minimum I think is a sign in the yard.
Right. Yeah. Because that's I had just started this last month, and I have three homes, and only one of them I could get a sign in because the other two are with realtors, and they didn't want me to put a sign up. So
go back to the seller and say ask your realtor if he'd mind if I put a rent to buy sign up there. I bet they won't have a problem at all. I see a lot of properties out there that say for rent or rent to buy and have a realtor sign out there. They have two different phone numbers on there.
Okay.
So,
excellent.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Who else?
Hey, Joe, this is Dennis down in Georgia. I'm one of your new people. The only email that I got from you was for this call. So I need information on what we need to bring to.
Okay. I'll why don't you give me a call after the call?
Okay.
And we'll talk.
Okay.
Because we should get all that taken care of.
I appreciate it.
You bet.
Joe, Ken Ingram from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hey, Ken.
I kind of got in late. Are you recording this?
Yes, it's all recorded.
Okay. I'll wait for the CD to come out now.
Okay.
Thanks.
Did you have a question?
I've got a lease option, and I kind of messed up on the paperwork, and I ended up having to pay rent before I could get somebody in there.
Okay. And then, now, do you have a tenant in there?
No, I'm running an ad for a tenant.
Okay. Now, that's a problem.
Yeah. Live and learn.
Right. Well, so how much monthly you got going out?
I got the property for $800 a month.
Right.
And I'm renting it for $895 with a $100 lease option and $3,000 option fee. And then I got a $10,000 increase on the price. I optioned it for 2 years, and then I'm selling an option for 1 year.
So tell me how much you're selling it for?
I bought it for $125 on a 2-year option, and I'm selling it for $135 on a 1-year option.
Okay. And then you're going to ask for how much for as a lease option fee?
$3,000.
Okay.
And $100 a month above the $95.
Well, here's what I'd do. Because your monthly payment is going to eat you up real quick. I'd go back to the seller and say, you know, I'm new at this. I made a mistake. Here's what I can do. And you know, you've already signed this lease, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Live and learn.
Yeah.
We're better on the next one.
Yeah. Because you don't have enough spread here even to make it worth. You're doing what a lot of guys call a sandwich lease or something. Is that what?
Right.
You didn't learn this from me, by the way. And I'm sorry, I'm beating a lot of people up on the phone today. I apologize, guys.
It's all right.
Don't ever buy a property with a lease option. There's no reason ever to do it unless you're going to assign it. What we're doing with this for rent method is assigning a lease option. We're not buying it on lease option. There's too many risks involved. There's too little control that you have over the deal. If you're going to buy a property, get the deed. You want to have your name on the deed. You want it subject to or multi-mortgage or land contract at the very least.
Okay.
But don't ever buy on a lease option. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do the lease option memo method where you get a lease option on a property and then you assign your right to buy it on lease option to somebody else for a fee, for a lease
option.
That's
what your program is?
That's the for rent method. My program is, we do a whole bunch of different things. You know, we're looking for how can we optimize the stuff without taking any risk and not spending any money and being safe doing it. And never having money coming out of our pocket monthly. You never want to be in that position.
Hey, Joe.
And I really empathize with you on this because that's what the way a lot of people do this. A lot of people, they'll go, they do it even worse. At least you're doing it smarter than a lot of people do. A lot of people will go out there, they'll put 10% down on a new property, they'll get a new loan for it, and then they'll go out and find a tenant to be their, you know, and be a landlord. I mean, that's just like really high risk. You got all this stuff on your back. If things go south, you're really stuck. Now with you, you've got this lease on there and you've got to make those payments or you've got to work out something with the seller to try to solve that problem. And, I would see, you know, what would it take to get out of this deal? I'd go talk to him and say, look, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have done it this way. And I see that now. I'm going to continue to try to get a lease option tenant in here. But it's going to eat me up to pay this every month, and it might make more sense, you know. And then I'm afraid we're going to get into this eviction and all this other stuff, and I don't want that to happen. What can we do to fix the problem? I mean, what are you willing to do work with me? If I can make one more month's payment, you know, maybe I can get get a tenant in there by that time, and we can get this taken care of. If I don't get somebody in there though, I'm not going to be able to make more than the next payment, and I just want to give you advance notice so. You know, see if there's something we can work out so that, you know, I don't want to get sued and I don't want it to all go south and I don't want to tie up your property. I want somebody to be in there so that, you know, neither of us are hurt. What can we do to make this work? And see if it'll work with you. You know, just one more thing. I think that if you, go back to somebody in humility and with an apology on your lips, man, that solves so many problems in the world. And, you know, when we make a mistake, or even if we don't make a mistake, an apology goes a long way. And, you know, whenever I get into a difficult situation, whenever I get angry or whenever I feel like somebody has ripped me off and I get angry, it costs me money. And usually an apology works a lot better, not just in business, but in life in general.
Hey, Joe.
Good luck with that. Yes, yes.
On that same situation there, when he runs his ad for his tenant buyer, if he puts in there that I think he said that he has $100 positive cash flow a month, puts in $100 a month rent credit on that, that might get him a tenant buyer a lot quicker.
Maybe so, yeah. But or you can lower your lease option fee. You know, you can bring it down to a couple of grand. You know, it's all about the monthly payment. You know, you could bring your monthly payment down to what you have to pay on it. Do a break even. But I would rather see you just get out of the deal altogether.
Okay.
Get out of it until you can find a tenant in there. So go talk to the seller. Try to get out of the deal. And then go back and try to find a lease option buyer for him. Try to set it up so that you can still put somebody in there and make some money off of it. Because you're doing all the right things. You put the deal together. You're doing most of the right things. You just structured the deal so that you had to close it before you had a buyer. That was your only mistake here, other than the fact that you bought it on a lease option, which I wouldn't do. I'd rather, if you're going to do it that way, then assign your lease option and just for a fee. Because there's not that much spread. If you took $5,000 out of it, there's only $5,000 left, and you have to manage the property during that time. You don't want to do that. If there was $50,000 of equity in there, then it might be worth, you know, managing it. But even then, you'd want to take title to the property, not have it on a lease option.
Okay.
Hopefully that makes sense.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
All right. I can take I'll take five more minutes here if anybody else got a question.
What if you put a vendor sign in the front yard and the people go talk to the sellers and they directly rent it to him?
That's possible. One of the things that we use is these lease option memos. I don't know if you guys have seen those, but we've got the lease option memo. It's a one-page memo. Says I have the right to lease option this property, and my intention is to put a sign in the yard and go find a, you know, a lease option tenant, and then you know, sign this contract to them. And on my lease option memo, it says that if the seller at any time wants to cancel this, he can. Basically, if he wants to sell it to somebody else, he can do that. It makes it real easy for the seller to accept, by the way. And one of the things that I tell everybody to tell the seller this when you're talking to him. I said, look, this contract, this lease option memo, I call it the stab me in the back contract because it allows you to stab me in the back. I mean, I know that most people are honorable people. Most people won't rip me off. Most people won't cheat me. Most people won't steal from me. Most people will act honorably in these transactions. And, you know, that's why I'm willing to do this. Every once in a while, somebody gets me, you know. When you start using verbiage like that with these people, they understand if they do that to you, they're going to rip you off. And they're going to have to take that label from you. Now, whether they care about that or not, that's, you know, depends upon them. They may not care. But I find that most of the time, that doesn't happen. Now, if you have the seller who lives in the property, and you send potential lease option tenants over to look at the property and let the seller show the property, that's a lot more likely to happen. If the seller shows that property to one of your people, he is a lot more likely to go around you than if you take it to a vacant house.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, but sometimes they live in the property and there's nothing you can do about it except show up with your tenant buyers. Go there and show them the property yourself. Or have one of your people do it. Got it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any others?
One more. Say, Joe, if you make over a certain dollar amount of profit, say like you're doing the rent to own, the landlord method where you're just assigning your lease option, and instead of making $5,000, you make $10,000 or $15,000. Is there some point where you want to hide how much you're making from the owner?
I don't think so. You know, who was it? There was one teacher, one real estate teacher. I heard somebody say that he said that tell them that you're going to make an obscene amount of money. I don't know who said it, but it was some other real estate teacher. But I think it's a great idea. Just tell them up front. Like, I intend to make an obscene amount of money on your deal. And that way, when it happens, if it happens, which it probably won't, but if it happens, then they don't have much to complain about. You told them it was going to happen. Now, you want to try to put yourself into as much control over these deals as you can. Lease option, the for rent deal, gives you a little bit less control than some of the other methods. If you take a property subject to, you can make an obscene amount of money and the seller won't have anything to say about it. If you do a simultaneous closing, you know, on an auction, it won't matter because the seller's not even going to see the new buyer. If you do a deal where you're going to pass money through the first buyer to you, if you can find a good, solid way to do that legally, then the seller sees exactly how much money you're making, and it becomes maybe a bigger issue if you're making $100,000 or $50,000 or something. So, does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good.
Good question, Joe. This is Eric. Is $5,000 pretty much a standard lease option fee, or is it actually a percentage of the value of the property?
I think it depends on what you can get. It's all a matter of what is your starting price on the property. If you're dealing in properties that are $50,000, sometimes it's hard to get $5,000. If you're dealing in $100,000, sometimes it's hard to get it. But I kind of like the idea of 5% if I can get it, or 3%. But if you're in the $200,000 and $300,000 or $500,000 properties, I mean, Bob, he'll get $5,000 on a $300,000, $350,000 property, and then when he gets up over $500,000, he makes sure he gets $10,000 for him. So everybody has their own comfort level, and a lot of that you're going to learn with your own community by running the ads and finding out how much money your buyers have. So what you do, you don't set your lease option fee. You find out how much your buyers got. So you never advertise your lease option fee.
Okay.
You just advertise that there's going to be a down payment if you want to, but then you can then you get them on the phone, you ask them how much you got for a down payment. And whatever they say, you ask them if they got more. Oh, you got $5,000? If you could come up with a 7, I know we could make this work. Could you come up with a 7? Well, maybe. Or absolutely not. Or whatever. And then you go with it. And you just, because it's not what you deserve that matters. It's what you negotiate. So, that answer it?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Hey, Joe.
Yes.
I wonder if you could expound upon or elaborate on Ozum's funnel philosophy and how that relates to your core material and getting started in the business.
Well, the funnel concept is about getting as many leads as you can to go into the mix, and then you know, processing those. This is pretty standard marketing tactics. You get as many people into the process as possible, and then a few of them are going to come out at the bottom. And it's a numbers game. So the way to you know, you can increase your numbers by the more personal you get and the more sales skills you put on each lead. But you want to use the leads the most effective way that you can. You know, there's a couple of different philosophies about the way you get leads. One, like I think I was talking about earlier on this call, or maybe it was on the earlier call I did today, I can't remember. But the people that opt into your, like your sellers, you know, the sellers list, if they opt into that list, there's a very good chance that they've read that paper and they're going to say yes to the lease option memo when you do it. Now, if they just leave a message on your voicemail, those people are a lot less likely than the people who opted in to do the deal with you. So, but you get a lot fewer people to opt in than you do to leave a message. So does it make more sense to go after the many that aren't as qualified or the few that are more qualified? And I think it comes down to your own personal style, how much time you want to spend on it, and how automated you are. Because I want as many leads as I can possibly get. And I think Awesome's the same way. We just want to, because we know we can monetize them in a lot of different ways. Where sometimes it makes sense that all I want to do is, you know, if somebody says, I just want to do these kind of deals, that means you want to try to really qualify for those kind of deals and only deal with the cream of the crop. Because you're dealing with them personally. See, I don't deal with them as personally on that level. I send them out emails and get them to finally make a decision and say yes, and then you know, write a check. That's my goal. So I have to spend less time with them, but I have to get more people into the funnel to make that happen because they're less qualified leads. If I take them to the spot where it qualifies them more, they're going to be more qualified leads. You know, I don't know if you guys have kind of looked at my funnel for bringing people into my mentor program. You know, I bring them into this newsletter, and then I send them information about it. And I ask them on that information, so, you know, read this information. If you're interested in the mentor program, give me a call. Please don't call me unless you've read this and are interested, because I don't want to spend time with them if they're not serious about what they're doing. Now, if I let everybody call me, you know, I could probably make more sales, but it would take a lot more of my time. So you have to make decisions about how much time do you want to spend on a specific task, and at what point does it become profitable or not profitable.
And so the return on your investment has to be optimized for what you're looking for.
Exactly.
Be it cash or time.
Exactly. Plus, you also need to look at cost per lead. And then effectiveness of those leads, you know, what the conversion is on those leads. So it's, you know, how much is it? Then it becomes cost per sale. So, you know, when we're trying to get buyer leads or seller leads, we want to say, okay, so those leads are going to cost me 50 cents, or they're going to cost me $5, they're going to cost me $25, or they're going to cost me, you know, I've got a lead source right now that's costing me about $35, but they're converting out at about $400 because they're good leads. So, you kind of have to look at the whole process, and the only way you're going to really get down to that kind of numbers is to be good at this. You got to do it a while, and you got to go through the process. So, but for most of you guys, and I know some of you guys are really experienced, and I don't want to denigrate that, but most of you guys you're starting out in this. Mm-hmm. If I were you, the place that I would start would be I'd get on the phone with the Ferret guys. And I do this for rent method. It's a real easy way to get started. You can just call these landlords up and say, hey, you know, I see you've got your house, you know, for rent. Would you consider selling it rent to buy rather than just renting it? And one out of three will say, yes, I'll do that. And then you tell, and you can tell them, look, I've got, you know, however many buyers you've got, I've got 23 buyers. And if you just run one ad or put out five signs, you're going to get 20 or 30 buyers really quickly and within a couple of weeks. And you'll be able to do it from that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Okay, thanks, Joe.
Okay. All right, I'm going to take one more call, one more question, and then I'm going to wrap it up for today. We're well past our 2 hours. I think I was planning on an hour and a half. This is
Okay, let me just go with a simple question. You probably have answered this out. So what you pocket is the lease option fee, right? That's what you put in your pocket.
If you're doing the lease option, the for rent method?
Yes.
Yes. You're taking the lease option fee, that in the simplest form. So if you write up this lease option memo, it's a one-page memo. The landlord says, yes, I'll lease option the property to you. And you got to use a memo like this. You can't just go out and find somebody a lease option buyer for their property unless you're an agent because then you'll be acting as an agent. The way we're doing it, you're acting as, and that's against the law, by the way. The way we're doing it is we're acting as the principal in the transaction. That means that we're the buyer. So we're the lease option. We have the right to buy this property, and we have the right to assign our right to somebody else for a fee. So that's what
somebody else could be the seller.
That somebody else is going to be the new buyer. So the seller is selling it to you on a lease option. You're not going to close that unless you find a new buyer to assign that right to. You're then going to assign your right to that new buyer, and that buyer is going to actually lease option, is going to take your right to lease option that property from the original seller. He's going to pay you the lease option fee as the assignment fee for that contract, and then he is going to pay the monthly fee to the seller, and then ultimately the payment to that seller. Now, if that seller is selling it, he wants $150,000 for his property, and you're going to sell it for $5,000, you're going to assign it for $5,000, well, what you're going to do is that new buyer is going to pay $155,000. They're going to pay $5,000 lease option fee that's applicable, that applies to their down payment, and then they'll still owe $150,000 to the seller.
Mm-hmm.
See how that works?
Yes.
Okay. All right, great. All right, guys. Well, it's been an interesting call. I really appreciate all your great questions, and hope I didn't beat anybody up too badly. I really care that you guys succeed at this, and I want to hear your stories, and I want to hear what happens with it. And I love it when I get all this positive feedback, because I get so much good stuff from you guys. And also, just be aware that we've got this mentor program, and this is where we do stuff together, and we can make this stuff happen together. And I'm doing a lot of partnering with my mentor students now, and we're doing auctions together. We're all over the country, and we're doing a lot of stuff together, and I'm working with them to make that happen. So I'd love to work with you guys if you want to get involved. I don't partner with anybody except the people that are in my mentor program right now, just because I don't have the time to do that with everybody. But if you're in the mentor program and would like to be in, would love to talk to you about it. I want to make sure everybody that comes in, I want to make sure that it's right for them. I want to make sure that they understand that it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It's a business-building program. And the same with all the stuff that I teach. This is not get-rich-quick. This is a business, and you got to treat it like a business. And there are a couple of skills that you need to be able to be successful at this. And if you don't have them, you have to develop them. They're all developable skills. You're not born with any of this stuff. One is your ability to have some experience maybe in sales. And you don't have to do sales here. You're doing a lot of consultative type selling. You're not trying to push anybody into something they don't want to do. You're wanting to find win-win situations for people. And the other thing is being an entrepreneur. If you've ever had a business in your life, you'll understand the things that are needed to be an entrepreneur and what it takes to get yourself going and make yourself do the work and not be afraid. One of the things I tell my mentor students all the time, you need to learn to lean into your fear. You always need to go a little bit past what your comfort level is and lean towards your fear, because it'll take you to the next level. If you're always in your own comfort zone, you can't go to the next step. You have to lean forward to take the next step. And that's what you're going to lean into the fear of what scares you the most. And a lot of times talking to people on the phone scares people. And if you can get past that and just make the calls and just start asking people if they'll do these deals, you'll learn. Even if you don't know how to get through the deal all the way, just start the process and learn it. If you're in the mentor program, I can help you get to the next step and the next step. But even if you're not, you can figure it out as you go along. I mean, it's a little bit harder if you're doing it on your own, but you can still figure this stuff out. You've got the basics, right off the bat. And if you got some of my other material, you've got even more than that. But so there's no reason you can't do this with or without my help. So I just want to encourage everybody to move forward on this stuff, because it really can change your life. It really can make a huge difference in what you're doing. And I've got so many people that have gone through my program that are no longer working their regular jobs, that are doing this stuff full time. And people that haven't gone through my program that have done it on their own, just using the materials they've learned from me. So you don't have to spend the money if you don't have the money to get involved. I know that's the reason why a lot of you aren't in the program, because it's really expensive. But you don't have to have me to make it happen. It just makes it easier. And if you don't have the money and you got the time, then you take the time and you learn how to do it. If you've got more money than you've got time, then you spend the money and you do it that way.
Wednesday, March
All right, everybody. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you coming on the call, and we'll have this. We'll do this again in a few months.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah. Right. Is Bob still on the line? Bob?
All righty. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bob.
Joe, bye.
Is Bob still on the line? Hello?
Thank you, Mr.